Hey, this is Cleveland Brown, and you're listening to the About Last Night podcast. I guess your TV must be broken. Haha, just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. You're bored.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to our dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. It's about last night.
You're right, Judd Apatow. It has all worked out. Like we're just doing this for fun, not for for anything else.
Who are the advertisers?
I mean, we'd like to just we like to hold off on that until.
I'd like to know who I'm supporting. What products?
MeUndies. No. Well, I'll tell you the sponsors we are shooting for. Yes. Jamba Juice.
Yes.
Constantly trying to get the Jamba.
Okay.
We desperately try to throw them in almost every podcast because if we get sponsored by Jamba Juice and I can get free razzmatazzes,
yes,
I'm going to be thrilled.
So if I just keep talking about how much I like Jamba Juice, I can change your fortunes.
Well, and
you can, I'm sure.
You can. And
it's a delicious series of juices.
I'm sure that was their goal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to ask you about that because you are definitely one of the few people in this town where, and I hope you realize this, where if you decided today, like, you know what, that actor, that actress, that comedian, you could change their lives.
That juice business.
Overnight. That juice business, whatever.
Yes, I can change people's fortunes.
Yeah.
Is that weird?
And send them spinning off into some hell they never thought about. I can change their lives, so suddenly
they've thought about it. I think everyone's thought about the potential hell that comes with the blessing and the curse of being super successful. Yeah,
like just on a dime, I can make it so you can't walk outside without every stranger asking for a selfie for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
for literally the rest of your life.
Yeah,
and then right now, Amy Schumer is listening to this going, that son of a bitch.
Has that happened to you the more you started to put yourself, once you stand up became a priority again and you were just, I mean, you've always been, on shows and whatnot to promote movies and shows. But, I mean, just even more exposure now, do you find yourself getting stopped more and just
the
bugged?
Lack of interest in me is wonderful. It's because I'm
like a Muppet performer.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody knows who Elmo is.
Yeah, I am Frank Oz.
Yeah,
I remember I went to see a Clippers game with Gary Shandling, decades ago.
Yeah,
and we were walking in, and just a couple of people were like, "Hey, Gary Shandling, you're funny, man."
Yeah,
and Gary turned to me and said, I have the perfect level of fame. Almost nobody walks up to me, but when they do, they are thrilled.
Yeah.
And I have one similar, which is almost no one walks up to me, and when they do, they're not even that interested.
Yeah, Freaks and Geeks was cool, I guess.
Maybe they're just overwhelmed with how much cool shit you've done that they don't even know where to start.
Well, people,
I feel like that's a legitimate.
I always joke that people always say hello to me on the move. Like, people literally don't think it's worth stopping, but as they walk by, I'll just hear, like your shit.
Which, by the way, hey, perfect.
Yeah. Yes.
That is, you're not complaining about that because I feel, especially in this town, there's a level of obsession over stardom and fame where some people, if they see someone else take a selfie with you, they're like, who's that dude?
Yes, and I want to get when I'll figure out who it is later.
Yeah, now I'm just going to throw their face on the, who's this face.com. By the way, if that's not a thing, that's a billion-dollar idea.
Trademark it. Somebody can go trademark it.
Yeah, and then do that, because I get that where someone comes up, like one person in a million will recognize me from comedy, and then they'll come up and they'll take a selfie with me. Then half the block thinks I'm Dinklage.
Yes.
And then they just come up like, oh, well, there's got to be one of the famous ones. There's like two of them, right?
Yeah, and will you just stick with it like, I'm Dinklage?
Yeah.
Well, now I do because I'm trying to ruin Dinklage's career.
Yes. So from the inside.
Yes. So I will go full Trump. No, yes. Absolutely not. But yeah, like I'm trying to ruin Dinklage's career because I figure I'm the next one up.
Exactly. Yes, so. I'm in. There would be a hole there for you to fill.
Absolutely.
There was a time when we went to a Seahawks game when we were up in Seattle doing shows, and a friend of ours was like, "Hey, I'm running this player's suite. You guys can come in during halftime, just hang out." And then we're hanging out, and then at one point, one of the guys who ran the suite just goes, "No fucking way. We men. And I look over at Brad, and he just looks at me and just goes, and nods his head like we're fine.
Like, go with it.
Like, and then Brad goes, "Hey!" And he goes, "Guys, let's take pictures." And then he was like, "Dude." And then the guy who was running the suite goes, "All right, guys, get out of here." And the guy goes, "No fucking way." He goes, "You think I'm kicking Wee Man out of my suite?" And I was like, "And Wee Man's buddy, you know?"
Yeah. So sometimes I'll let that go.
Exactly.
Do you ever get stopped and people say, like, "I like your shit," but it's for – because, again, there's just – I mean, I don't even know if you sometimes just forget how much stuff you've done. But, like, does somebody ever go, "Man, Celtic Pride"? Like, do they just deep cuts like that?
Deep cuts. Yeah, I get heavyweights. Mm-hmm. Heavyweights is the one that people remember.
By the way, that is, like, I mean, I was a true fat kid. So that film, like, yeah, hey, how did one you of Paul Feig's best acting roles.
Works. Yeah. Yes.
How did I perceive it? I loved it.
Yeah.
Because it was so, you know, it was just like, you know, you see like a movie made for you. You know, you're just like, I would like, and then also, you're all the right fat kid elements too, like the snacks and the bunks. Yeah. Like, I was just like, that's genius. I got to do that. Mom, we need a snack bunk, you know? But also just the way, there's a lot of, I mean, and you're just like the best at this, like the right amount of heart and the right amount of funny and like a character, that Stiller character to me is like one of the greatest movie characters of all time.
Oh my God, he was so funny when we did it. And I guess that movie in a way was the beginning of other work that we all did with Freaks and Geeks of underdog kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to find a way to do something funny, but ultimately just very sympathetic to these kids. And when it came out, we got such terrible reviews.
Did it really?
Because I think on some level people thought, you must be making fun of that.
Right, just on the surface, a movie called Heavyweights starring fat kids, you're like, oh God.
Yes.
Like, if you haven't seen it, it's just going to be like, it's just going to be nonstop fat jokes, and there's going to be some sort of teeter-totter thing at one point. Like, you just, like, have that all in your head. And then you actually watch the movie, you're like, oh, no, you were very sympathetic, a lot of heart. And I think that's a trend that you like to put in the vast majority of your project.
Yeah, where does that come from? When you first started filmmaking, or just, like, the people you looked up to, were you just like, oh, cool, the stuff I like has that proper balance?
It's funny. I must have had things like that I just appreciated when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did, you know, my stand-up special
which
for
is coming
Netflix,
out
December 12th.
Yes.
And one of the things I do in it is I read a letter, you know, a poem that I wrote when I was 14 about my parents' divorce.
Okay.
When did they split?
Like between 8th and 9th grade. So I wrote this poem about it. And in the poem, I'm basically saying, like, life is terrible, but maybe all this suffering will lead to me writing better jokes. But at 14,
oh my God,
I had some awareness of pain leads to jokes. Probably because I always knew Richard Pryor's story. Like, the worse it is.
Yeah. When you're raised in a whorehouse in Peoria and you light yourself on fire, holy shit, you're going to be hilarious.
Yeah. And like Seinfeld was talking about that. You know, I worked on his special.
Yeah, the most recent one, yeah.
About like, this is, you know, this is what I had to work with. And I used to say that as a kid. When I first did stand-up, I used to do a similar joke where I said, you know, if I was, sometimes I wish I was raised in a whorehouse because then I would be funnier right now. Mm-hmm. I used to say it when I was bombing. And on some level, I must have had sympathy for people I thought were struggling. Mm-hmm. So when I was a kid, that might be, you know, the kid in Fast Times at Ridgemont High who worked at the movie theater.
Yeah.
And you remember?
Yeah.
And he had the friend who sold concert tickets, the scalper.
Yeah,
I would go, I relate to that kid, the little guy who's having a problem. And in a way, the movies that we made and a lot of the TV was about that guy. Was his name Ratner?
Yeah, he might have been.
I don't think it was Brett Ratner.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
But I always liked those stories, and even Stripes, which was two idiots whose lives were going terribly. Bill Murray's driving a cab. Harold Ramis is like teaching, you know, English as a second language, and they join the army because their lives just suck. Mm-hmm. I always felt like, oh yeah, I'm like one of these suffering wise ass geeks.
Yeah,
and that made me want to basically make the supporting actor or actress the lead.
Wow.
In a way, it's as simple as that. Like, whoever used to play the friend.
Yeah.
Seth Rogen used to be like the friend.
Yeah.
And well, what if the friend, what if John Candy's the lead? I used to love like John Candy is the lead, Uncle Buck, things like that.
Yeah, and even, you know, in like a Forgetting Sarah Marshall, that like in, you would almost want that story to be told from the perspective of maybe like either the Sarah Marshall character or
Jack McBrayer.
Yeah, absolutely, Jack McBrayer. Because Virgins in Hawaii, which I think I rented two nights ago, very, very funny. But yeah, it's like that other guy that the because I know Sarah Silverman always talked about how she's always cast as like the snarky friend or whatever.
Yes.
And it's like you're taking that character that I feel like a lot more people can relate to and bring it to
the
forefront.
Well, we all relate to the snarky friend because if you take a moment to go, why is the friend snarky?
Mm-hmm.
They're always underneath it, very sensitive and sweet, and the edgy jokes are a cover for something. And if you have enough time, like in Trainwreck, because Amy Schumer, of course, is like the snarky friend, you go, oh, there's a whole rainbow of stuff going on that's fascinating that makes you have this defense mechanism in life that makes you funny and tough. And that's always what I find interesting is, you know, what's beneath the attitude?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How much of the of your because my folks split when I was 9, and I feel like that is a I didn't write myself a poem, but I definitely I wish I did.
Cooked himself a Pop Tart.
Yeah. I double fisted Pop Tarts and dipped them in Cool Whip, and that also was just as effective. But like, did you find? I mean, because not a lot of kids at my age were going through that, so it was kind of this like unique thing, and so there was like I had a different perspective, and if I would make jokes. Like, I made jokes pretty early on, even like 10 and 11, just about it.
Yeah.
And people were, like, really thrown off by it. Even parents. I remember being at, like, friends' parents' houses, and I said some joke about my dad not being here or something like that. And it was, like, to me, it was funny. And it was also, like, how I was already, like, dealing with it.
Yes.
And the parents were just so uncomfortable with it, which made me kind of want to do it more because I was, like, didn't really like their parents because they would give me shit for eating all their snacks. And but so, like, was how much of that do you think directly – I don't know, just gave you a different way of looking at things.
I think any pain you have as a kid tunes you into other people's pain.
Yeah.
So if you're suffering, your radar goes up and you understand why other people are suffering and you feel bad for them.
Yeah.
Whatever their suffering is.
Sure. You're almost more akin to it, just like, oh, that's why that kid's mean. And that's why that kid's that kid's a bitch, and like you get it. Like that
How many
one cries
kids have
a lot.
You call bitches, really?
I call a lot of kids bitches. There was one in Ralph's the other day. He was staring at me.
Yeah,
he was
reaching for a cereal on the top shelf and staring you down.
Yeah, and like and then he told his mom like, "Why does that kid get to have a beard?"
Yeah,
it was.
But it does tune you into something.
Yes. Yeah,
that. You know, I would assume that you see the world in a completely different way than most people.
Yeah, about a foot and a half lower. So just lower the camera a foot and a half, then you're like, wow, that's what Brad sees.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're doing this, you know, we're working on a script with the Lucas brothers.
Okay.
And they were, you know, talked a lot about how when they were kids, they, you know, grew up, you know, at times in dangerous places.
Yeah.
That they were treated like unicorns.
Yeah.
And so in a way, twins, they were treated better. Because people were so happy to see them for some reason.
Well, and in general, people are generally happy to see midgets. Like, like you're never upset.
No.
Like I know when you walked in and you saw a Jew, you're like, okay, it's Hollywood. I've seen that a lot. But then you see me and you're like, okay, it's going to be a good time.
It's going to be a good morning. 8 a.m. is not that early.
Yeah, it's fine.
I wasn't. I was actually enraged. I was the other way. I was
the only one.
Like, that and that's the other perspective that you bring. Most people happy when they see dwarves.
Yes.
You're like, I can get mad about this.
How about the idea of seeing, you know, like, you know, differences and people who feel other.
Yeah.
And so like when Paul Feig, you know, brought me the script to Freaks and Geeks, I just thought, oh my God, no one ever talks about the nerds and the potheads.
Right.
And I'm instantly attracted to, well, wow, no, that's like a terrain that has never been dealt with.
Yeah.
What does it feel like to be those guys? And I think that when, you know, when you're young and in whatever way it is, you feel like you took a beating, mm-hmm. you want to talk about how you survived it and who was nice to you and who wasn't nice to you and what that, the experience of that growth was. 'Cause for me, what was different was all my friends' parents were divorced.
Oh.
By the end of high school, no one survived.
Wow.
And so one by one, we helped each other through.
Oh, my God.
You had a support group going.
And by the end of it, we were all just wandering the streets with no one paying attention to us.
Yeah.
Like our parents back then in the early 80s, school would end. There's no cell phones. There's nothing.
Yeah.
You just wandered the streets till dinner time.
Yeah.
And you were on bicycles and dangerous
places. And your folks just go, I hope you're home for dinner.
They didn't even consider that there was a possibility of there being a problem.
Right.
And when your parents are divorced, they also get busy with their own lives, with whatever they're doing.
They're trying to set up their next life.
Yes. They're dating. They're trying to make enough money. Now everyone's got to pay for other people.
Yes.
And so you're left to fend for yourself like dogs.
Yeah.
And we loved it.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure,
I remember,
it's independence.
I remember as a kid, me and my friends just going to a diner at like 14 at 1 in the morning.
Yeah.
And we thought, this is so great. But we didn't realize, like, we've been abandoned. We just thought, oh my God, we're so adult right now.
Yeah.
We have money and we're buying food in this restaurant.
Right.
And no one's kicking us out of here.
There's so many times in high school where we was just like, it's 11 o'clock at night on a Friday.
Yeah.
What are we going to do? Denny's. And that's
what
we did.
Dude, after so many high school plays, that was like the thing. We would all go there or some sort of spot.
Sure.
And
24 hours.
Like, and staying there late and just the idea of like breaking the rules. Is there a is this super early for you, by the way? Or
do
up at 5? I was trying to just figure out, like, is it did the being a dad get you up early first, or was it just your work?
Ruined my clock. My clock is destroyed.
Because you're a comic at heart, right? I mean, like, that's what got you. I mean, and
my creativity's been destroyed by parenting in so many ways. Because my clock for creativity is, like, it wants to start writing around 9 or 10 at night. And I have to go to sleep at 11. So I don't write at night. But my best work would be if I wrote from 10 till 2 in the morning. That's when my brain
relaxes.
Does it
always been like that?
And it's all gone.
That's that's how I am, and I don't know if that's ever going to, and I'm like, and there are times when I'm just like, I need to be asleep right now, but like,
you feel it happening, you get relaxed.
I like something too about, I feel like everything else is shut down, and it almost feels like I have no distractions.
Yeah, the
like,
phone no one can reach
me.
And so that's messed me up completely, and I never recovered. I never creatively recovered from, like, because what I would do, I would work till 2 a.m. I would sleep till noon. I'd watch like a season of The Real World, and I would procrastinate all day. I would just eat. I'd go see a movie. I would do anything but write. And then at some point, I would get tired. And right when I got tired, the part of my brain that was a critic would just get too tired to tell me to shut the fuck up. And whatever would come would come. But like, if I'm fresh in the morning, the voice in my head that wants to tell me to shut the fuck up, you suck, the critical voice is awake and ready to shut me down.
So you're saying since the birth of your children, all your work has suffered.
I
don't know if that's really positive for you.
No.
But that, I mean, I'm sure that's strange where you just kind of have to flip your internal clock that way.
Yes.
Because kids don't care that you were out until 2 a.m. the night before.
No, I can't do it. I can't say, you know what, I'm just going to stay up and write and have 4 hours sleep.
Right.
You know, at some point you get older and you don't recover the next day.
Yeah.
You can do it once and then you're dead for a few days.
Yeah. what were the biggest things becoming a dad that you feel like your work did change for the better? Like, did you find yourself with just an even bigger, obviously probably perspective of life and just seeing things, right? But did you find like an extra gauge of funny that you didn't know about because of it? Like, what did it truly do to the work?
At every stage of your kid's life, you remember how you were at that stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're just having flashbacks. You know, my daughter's 15 So suddenly you just remember everything from when you were 15.
That's kind of cool, right?
Yeah, it tunes you into every phase.
Yeah.
Even when they're little, you go, yeah, I guess I was happy at six. I guess I was kind of cool.
This whole time you thought you were a depressed six-year-old?
Yeah. I remember also there was like a moment when I realized like I'm smaller than everyone because I was a year ahead.
What's that feeling like, Judd?
You
would be smaller than everyone.
Let's be quiet. Yeah, you don't understand.
Quiet, dwarf, quiet. Tall person talking.
But I was littler because I was born in December. My parents, like, I should have been behind a year.
Oh, but
so that I would be the oldest.
Yeah.
But I was the youngest. But I didn't, you know, when you're a kid, no one tells you that. Oh, by the way, you're a year smaller than everyone. And then you just suck at sports. And your whole childhood is this moment where they pick teams. And your pick last, which is this daily humiliation, right?
Yeah,
every
sure.
day, I'm going to brand you like a cow as an idiot. And
by the way, everybody should be picked last at some point at recess because it's a special fucking feeling.
It's also a slow humiliation. It's like, we'll take Bill. And then you're waiting there. It's literally like a cow auction.
You also know you're going to be last.
You know you're going to be last because when you're picked last, you also get a position. That the ball never comes
way right field.
Way right field.
You're like in the way woods. Right field.
You're like near the woods.
You're
in
the woods. Yeah. See if that old guy who lives next to the school has any more peanuts.
So like, basically the only way you're gonna get the ball is if Reggie Jackson walks in off the street and goes,
plays a random
"Hey
game
kids, you mind if I play?" Okay. Oh shit, the ball's coming to me today.
Yeah.
Reggie's
also,
playing.
There were no lefties. So if you got you put in right field,
yeah.
there was just no scenario the ball would go there. There was no kid who knew
no
how to hit it to right
hitters.
Field.
No.
Yeah.
And so you could never prove that they had made a misjudgment about you.
Yes.
And it happened for me, gym class every day,
oh, really?
Lunchtime every day through sixth grade.
Yeah.
You know, so it's seven solid years of you suck, and then on some level that became your definition with the girls
mm-hmm.
as, you know, wimpier.
Yeah.
And that's when I got into comedy. Like, in my head, I would watch TV. I would watch all the stand-ups on, like, the Mike Douglas show or Merv Griffin or something. And I mm-hmm. thought, oh, I'm like Jeff Altman. You know, I'm like this. I'm like Jay Leno. I'm like one of these weird people who's pissed off on the sidelines calling everyone an asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's my crew. And I always say what was interesting is, no one was interested in comedy. Like, when I was a kid, comedy was not popular. So,
What was it regarded? I mean, it was
no one gave a shit at all. Like, my friends, like, it wasn't even a thing that was discussed. So
was
if I was
the 70s,
yeah. So if I'm 10, it's 1977, and I'm watching a Make Me Laugh or some show. There was nobody I could go to and go like, did you see Gallagher on Make Me Laugh? like nobody cared. But I always had this thought in my head, which is, when I leave this school and I get into the real world, people will care.
Mm-hmm.
And if I really learn this, I will be in a position to get a job because no one is trying to get this job.
You saw it as an open industry where you're like, well,
yes.
no one's in this line.
Yes, it was like
everyone's in the pro baseball player line.
Exactly.
No one's in this line.
No one even knows this is a line.
Yeah.
And I did, as a little kid, know I can survive doing this, and the fact that you don't care is going to be my advantage.
That is crazy that you had that mindset.
Also, back then, there was none of this. There was no podcast.
Wow. Yeah,
so
you kind of did podcasting before. Like, because you, and this was covered in your book, where you...
Sick in the head.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, by the way. Holy shit. I mean, like...
Thank you.
Every chapter, it was just like another...
Because you went out and you interviewed artists and actors and producers and directors, like, and never with the thought of I'm going to publish them. You just interviewed people.
Yes.
First of all, where did you get the thought, and how did you accomplish the goal?
Well, this is what a nerd I was.
Yeah.
That even at that age, so this is around 83, 84 when I was doing the interviews, I was such a fan of just like the Phil Donahue show.
Dude, me too.
Just long interviews. There was a guy named Stanley Siegel in New York who had a late night show. He was the first guy to interview, like, you know, punk rockers and just fringe people.
Yeah.
And I thought, I got to talk to these people. How do I talk to these people? I loved it so much. I'm like, must get near them. And I thought, oh, this is a trick. Mm-hmm. The trick is, this is for a purpose, this radio station. But really, it was just so I could sit down with Jerry Seinfeld and go, how do you do it? Tell me how you do it. How do I get in? How do I get in?
Yeah.
And it really was the original comedy podcast.
Yeah.
And
broadcasting to an audience of one.
And that's why, yeah. I wouldn't even air it. And then.
You would just listen to it and just, I mean, study the game tape, yeah?
People said things that changed my whole perspective. Yeah. I mean, if you want to be a comedian and you're 15, 16 years old and someone says, hey, by the way, it takes 7 years to get good.
Yeah.
And you set your clock to 7 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you have patience. When you suck for 2 years, you don't even think anything's going wrong. You're like, I'm on my path. These are the suck years. And there was a lot of very simple advice. That's all in the book that all turned out to be exactly right. But now, because there's so many podcasts, I think kids see comedy as an industry they can get into, which is why there's a lot of good people in it. Mm-hmm. But back then, if I called a comic and said, do you want to do an interview? They said yes, because no one else was asking them. No one was asking Jerry Seinfeld to do an interview in 1983.
Because they just didn't have the awareness to think that they could get to him.
Where would it air?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was nowhere to even put it.
There's no long form.
There's nothing. There was no space. I mean, he might have gone on the radio to promote a club gig with a morning DJ. But other than that, there wasn't a place for him to speak seriously about what he does.
Yeah.
Just didn't happen.
When you'd walk into the rooms, was there anyone that saw you and was like, oh, I thought you were going to be like a 32-year-old writer?
Everybody seemed deeply disappointed. And I had this huge cassette player.
Mm-hmm.
I would bring like basically a boombox. It made for the first run of interviews. It's just a giant boombox. And then I got a tape recorder from the AV Club. One of those like kind of mint green, like army green.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the sound was so bad. Then finally I figured out how to buy a microphone for the last run of them. But it was, I remember walking in, I interviewed Steve Allen.
Wow.
But I take out this giant, like, boombox.
It's like, what are you going to do, breakdance, kid? Like, you throw out some cardboard?
But literally, I have a picture of it. It's hysterical. And I just was so naive, I didn't realize it looked crazy.
But how much preparation did you really construct, like, a nice map of questions so that they were like, okay, he's legit. Like,
yes.
How did you legitimize yourself?
Oh, I did write questions and research and try to be thoughtful. And that's why the interviews are okay, is I was a comedy nerd, and I did an okay job. I'm doing a documentary about Gary Shandling for HBO, and what's funny is how the documentary starts is an interview with him that I did when I was 16.
Oh, wow. God.
And then I went on to work with him, you know, most of my adult life, but it's funny that, you know, he hosted The Tonight Show, and we needed an interview of him discussing what it was like. And the only interview that existed was the one that I did. And my voice is high. I'm like, so what's it like to host The Tonight Show? You know, it's kind of a big deal to get the chance to try that.
They're like, is that Jewish Bert from Sesame Street? What was it like listening to those tapes for the first time? I'm sure people have asked
so
that a bunch.
Painful.
But is it really?
It's so painful.
Like watching an old voice. Set or something? Or?
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I tried to be funny. Because I so wish they think I'm funny.
Of course.
I rarely try, but when I do, it's a misfire. It's always so bad.
You're like, Apatow from the outside. Miss. Clang.
Like I said to Leno, and Leno was on Letterman a lot then, and I said, your career's going pretty good. But, how would you say it's going? I mean, it's like, you're selling out clubs. But you're not exactly selling out the Universal Amphitheater.
Oh, my God.
And Leno is so funny. He just goes, no, I'm not selling out the Universal Amphitheater.
Dick. Subtext, dick.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So that was the first time you met was the first time you met Shandling.
Yeah, over the phone, yes.
Yeah, and then when did you reconnect with him? Because that was a special relationship you had with Gary.
I used to host a lot at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, which is a great club.
Yeah,
that's probably where I really learned how to do stand-up.
Oh, really?
I used to host there all the time. And one night I was there with my manager, Jimmy Miller, who's still my manager, and Gary was coming in to perform. And Jimmy just goes, hey, you're hosting the Grammys. You should let Apatow write some jokes for you. And Gary could not have seemed less interested. I mean, it was just silence. You know, it, yeah. this an idea is yeah, not yeah. picked up on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a few months later, I was in Dallas at the Improv in Dallas, opening up for Kevin Rooney.
Oh my God!
Whoa. And I get a call. Gary needs jokes, so write him some jokes, fax them to him, and then call him the next day, see how he likes them. I may have talked to Gary on the phone briefly before I did it, and I just did the shows, and then mm-hmm. starting at whatever midnight, I stayed up all night and I wrote him like whatever 100 jokes,
yeah.
because I thought this is the moment I have to be the guy that you desperately need. How right. do I be the guy that's indispensable right now?
Yeah,
yeah,
and. I think he liked the setups, quite honestly. I think I wrote very clean setups, and then he wrote good punchlines. Like, I could explain a musical issue, like, oh, this is what's happening with the band Kiss right now.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what's happening with this country band.
Right.
And then he asked me to go to New York to be, like, on stage with him.
What?
At the show. So if you can imagine, I'm just a young knucklehead, and not a great stand-up, and he says, come to Radio City Music Hall, I'll put you up, jeez. And we'll keep writing jokes, and then you'll be on stage with me at the show. And the show is crazy. It's you know, Bono giving the Lifetime Achievement Award to Frank Sinatra.
And what?
Then Nicholson comes out and introduces Bob Dylan. This is all during the first Gulf War. It all happened in that period.
Yeah.
Okay. So Judith Light introduces Elton John. It's just like everyone's like, who, where are we?
Yeah. It was like 91, 92.
Though. Yeah.
Was that your first time at a huge venue too and just being
yes,
like,
this yeah. was, and to be on the inside, because I had worked at Comic Relief, but I was very far from the fun.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And
that's still amazing.
And
because now you're on the stage, and for our listeners that aren't familiar, a lot of times when there's an award show host, they have writers literally on the side of the stage, so yes. when something happens at yes. the show, they run to the side, and the writers pitch them four or five jokes right there.
And you know, the show is, you know, it's Eric Clapton playing Tears in Heaven, it's Tina Turner,
so funny stuff,
Peter Gabriel. I mean, it's like one of those, you know, when yeah. you look at who was on, it's Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh my God.
Yeah, early Chili Peppers.
There's a great
yeah.
picture that's in the documentary, which is I saw that Bruce Springsteen is there,
mm-hmm.
and I said to Gary, we're taking a picture with Bruce Springsteen. You're the host. We're allowed to do that.
Yeah. yeah.
Good move. And I had a disposable camera. This is how lame and, you know, young I was. Like, I'm going to get my disposable camera, and we are going to take a picture with Bruce Springsteen. And I still have the picture.
Good for you. Oh,
but and Gary was always very shy about that.
Sure.
And so at one point I said, hey, Gary, this is the second time I wrote it for him. It was during Larry Sanders. I said, hey, there's R.E.M., you should ask him to be on the show. And he's like, no, I don't ask people directly. That's what bookers are for. It's too embarrassing. I'm like, Gary, you just hosted the Grammys and yeah. killed. Now's when you ask him.
Yeah.
So Michael Stipe is walking by, and Gary goes, hey, you know, if you ever want to be on the Larry Sanders Show, we'd love to have you. And Michael Stipe just keeps walking, like, doesn't even turn and acknowledge the question. And then Gary goes, or I can go fuck myself.
Oh, God. Great.
Now, did he?
You gotta ask though.
Did he remember you at all, or did he
the
remember
interview?
Yeah, did he remember the interview?
No, I mean, I don't remember so much that he did, and I wouldn't bring things like that up.
Mm-hmm.
If I did, I probably took a while before I said, hey, I interviewed you for my high school radio station. I don't think I was bragging about that part of it.
Yeah.
Today's episode of the About Last Night podcast is sponsored by Stitch Fix. Oh, you know what that is. And if you don't, I'll tell you. So look, if you're a guy, you're probably like me and a lot of guys. You could probably think of a million things you'd rather be doing than shopping for clothes, right? Playing basketball, watching basketball, jerking off, eating food, talking to pretty girls that think you're cool, scrolling Facebook for old friends from high school that used to make fun of you and now are stupid. Also, parking, crowds at the mall, endless browsing, and lack of advice online. It's enough to make you want to just rock the same t-shirt and jeans for the rest of your life, but you can't because you got to adapt and you got to be you. And you can only be you if you use Stitch Fix Men. Oh, yeah. What have they done? Oh, just reimagined how to find and buy clothes, and you never even have to leave your house. It's that easy. All you got to do is go to stitchfix.com. stitch.com. That's STITCH.com. And tell them your sizes, your favorite type of clothes, and how much you want to spend. Then a personal stylist will get to work with you, handpicking new clothes for you based on your style and your budget. It's all for you, baby, okay? It's all for you. Like Janet Jackson said, 5 items are delivered right to your door. You try them on at home, and you only pay for what you keep. That's so great. If you don't like something, you send it back. You're not charged for it. Shipping is free both ways, so anything you don't want, you just send it back. And the exchanges are always free, too. That's fucking crazy. You can get your fix monthly, quarterly, or whenever you feel like, because guess what? No subscription required. That's actually pretty dope. A lot of places do that. Stitch Fix does not. It's easy. And the shipping is free, so why not give them a try? I promise you're going to be hooked, all right? Get started now at stitchfix.com/ALN, and you'll also get 25% off when you keep all 5 items in your box. stitchfix.com/ALN. Get started today. stitchfix.com/ALN. If you're a dude and you like clothes and you like feeling good about yourself, but you hate shopping, this is the deal for you. stitchfix.com/ALN, all right? Do it. I'm telling you, it's a great deal, okay? And I know about great deals. Fuck, I can't do that voice without wanting to punch myself in the dick.
What, was anyone ever an asshole to you in those interviews, and now you've come to know them later? And you don't have to name names, but...
Name there was names. Only one guy yeah. who I won't name.
Raffy.
Dude, if those tapes are around, please find them.
There was one guy, like, I'm doing an interview with him. It's like at a restaurant or something. I go downstairs to the bathroom, and suddenly like, he's in the bathroom. And he goes, let me see your dick. And I went, what? He goes, let me see your dick. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, I have a bet with another comedian that I could see your dick. Now I'm 16 years old.
What?
And so luckily,
you met Harvey Weinstein at 16 years
nice,
old.
Brad. Topical.
Wow. Good,
yeah.
and luckily, because you never know how much of a people pleaser you are,
right?
As a kid,
until you're asked
until someone says, yeah. "Let me see your dick." Yeah. And I was like, "No, what are you talking about?"
Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, I had enough Long Island "fuck you" in me.
Nothing like a good Long Island "fuck you."
Exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was the only, and it might have been the first part of a program he was running.
Yeah,
and it could have yeah. led to some bad.
It's so weird that now you get older and you look back and now you understand a little more about psychology and how some of that kind of stuff works.
Sure.
When you're like, oh shit, like yes. that's what was happening, and yeah. I think there's a lot of things like that when you look back at, as an adult with with some interaction and not just. Sexual predators, but yes. with just other things where you're just like, oh man, that's what led me to here, which led me to yeah. this, which led
sure. And we never talked about that stuff. Like now with my kids, we talked about that from birth. Like,
oh, really?
Be careful. Yeah. You can't trust people. You can't put yourself in weird spaces. You know, you have to be so aware of it. I only knew it from watching Different Strokes. When Gordon
they
Jump,
had a very special episode.
And Gordon Jump was yes. moving in on Gary Coleman, and honestly, that is the only way I knew. Like. Run
yeah
yeah
but my parents never talked about it. We didn't. It wasn't a thing in the culture. People are trying to get you.
Yeah
now like I can't imagine being a parent now where and like you have to have the conversation with your kids like, hey, don't send a picture of your stuff to anyone.
Oh sure. Yeah, ever. That's a big conversation. And then the simplest earliest version is every single thing that you do on your phone, you should assume other people are going to be able to see at some point.
Yeah, right.
And assume it's not private. Assume it exists somewhere that someone could get it.
Yep.
And so don't type anything that you yep. think is going to get you in trouble, because kids will do crazy jokes. And, you know, your kids say things. You're yeah. like, well, that is a career ender.
Yeah.
You literally will never enter the job market right. if you post this
yeah.
joke.
And now you can, like, screenshot. Like, yes. like even when you're – I think about that even texting with friends – when it's like I do a joke and then I literally have to go like, oh, wait,
yes.
don't – because you're not in the business. So don't like screenshot that and be like, oh, my friend Brad yes. is so funny. Like don't do that.
And the hard part is those are the best jokes.
Yeah. I know.
So you always want to shock your friends by saying yes. the wrong thing. Oh,
yeah. Chappelle yes. just said last night at the Comedy Store, he goes he said something. He goes, I realize now that could be perceived as kind of mean. He goes, but I just – he goes, I don't say it to be mean. He goes, I say it because it's the funniest thing to say.
Yeah.
And then he
yeah.
goes, sometimes the funniest thing is the meanest thing. And he goes, but it's all intent, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I love going to see him at the Cellar. I was I opened up for him at Radio City Music Hall.
Oh, on this last run?
Yeah, I bumped into him at the Comedy Cellar, and he was doing a couple of sets to get ready. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and I said, who's opening up for you tomorrow? And he's like, oh, he goes, you want to? And I was like, yeah, of course. So the lineup is like me and Chappelle and Lil Wayne.
Mary fuck kill.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
These is not like the other one.
I went to the first night of that run, and it was Kendrick Lamar and Neil and Dave. But it's like, I mean, that's crazy. Like, people don't even know, like, how incredible that is to get that lineup there.
It was so funny to get to do it, to be around it. But what was more fun was to go to the Comedy Cellar a few nights before that and watch him do the warm-up sets, because when he's at Radio City, he's so tight.
Yeah,
and
it's refined.
Watching him at the Cellar do a variation of the set, but really loose and improvising and rambling and interacting with the crowd. You know, it's a small crowd at the Cellar. As he searches for other ideas, is my favorite thing as a comedy nerd, getting to witness that.
Yeah,
I always think that's the only reason why I'm in comedy at all is to be at the Comedy Cellar 2 a.m. watching Chappelle figure stuff out.
Yeah, it's one of the amazing benefits of this business, where I think we're all comedy fans and we find ourselves in those situations, and even someone who's had as much success as you have had, you're still just like, oh god, this is so cool.
Yes.
Do you find your fandom has dwindled over the years, or are you still, like you just mentioned, like
it did for a long time? Because, you know, I did stand up from the time I was 17 till I was 24,
right?
And I think I burnt out a bit from just obsession, and then I really didn't follow it at all seriously till I started working with Amy Schumer when she was writing Trainwreck. And when we did Funny People, I began to watch.
That put you back in the clubs, right?
I did some sets, just kind of goofing around to write jokes for Adam. I just was trying to help create Seth and Adam's joke, so we would go do sets. Yeah. But
was that your first, like, Funny People, was that your first time back in a comedy club setting that you were?
Yes, where I really paid attention.
Because you weren't going to shows throughout the years. I mean,
I could have gone 10-12 years not walking into the Improv.
Wow.
But that's from being there 5-6 nights a week for 7 years.
And you were busy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I realized how good everyone was, and I also just started to miss hanging out with everyone. I missed just the tribe of it.
The hang is one of the coolest parts about going out to the comedy club.
Yeah,
as a comic.
I mean, for us to be at the store and hang with you is like fucking super cool. You know what I'm saying?
It's so fun.
That's, and it's just like, once you get into that community and that world, and like even last night, for me to casually be like, oh, and then I did my set, and then Chappelle went up to the Belly Room, and I sat with 40 people and watched it. Like, that's crazy that you have the opportunity to do that.
Sure, and that is one of the main reasons that I was into it, because I thought, I got to be a good comedian just so people like me enough so I have access.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that thinks, that's the only reason why I try to be good, is to have the respect of other people.
Yeah.
You know, so that I could be a part of the world of it. I mean, there really is a fan core, which is, oh, I have to be great at it to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Not I have to be great at it just to be great at it. It really is part of the whole organism of, oh, this is the life that I would want. And so that for me never really burns out. You know, someone special coming in or just seeing people experimenting. I'm always, you know, just see Marc Maron, you know, come into a club and he's in the middle of figuring stuff out. I almost, you know, that's the only bad part of doing stand-up, is you don't want to watch too much, because then you realize every subject is being handled.
Yeah. So it's so hard to write, because you're so like, oh, I could talk about my kid. Oh, wait, no, so-and-so talks about the kid.
Yes.
Okay, I talk about, no, so-and-so does that.
Yeah, that's the only drag, or I would watch much more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You brought your Netflix special, so I wanted one once again to go watch that when it comes out. Now, you're a guy that when you started getting back into stand-up, you could have made a phone call and in a month had a special on some network or Netflix or whatever.
PAX was looking to get into the comedy game.
Sinclair. Sinclair people.
Sure.
Some conservative comedy.
Sure. What made you hold off? Because now you've been doing stand-up again for...
Since the summer of 2014.
Yeah.
I was at Just for Laughs, and I did one headline show in 2016, that summer, and Netflix just happened to be there.
Yep.
Thank God I didn't know they were there, and I just did the long set, and they said, do you want to do a special? And I said, okay, but give me one more year. Because if I know I'm doing a special, I could really prepare well. And that's what I did. And they've been great. You know, we do that TV show Love for Netflix.
Yep, so great.
And that's been fun. We have a new season coming up in February.
Oh, really?
Or March. March, I think. And so I just, you know, then the fire's under your ass. Like, oh, a lot of people have specials. How do you make a special?
Special.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what sticks out? And,
yeah.
And how can it not be mediocre? So hopefully...
And you can happens. You mention, I mean, you were telling me at the store one night, and I think at Bonnaroo, I saw you doing what I think is somewhat what you incorporate in the special. Are you leaving that to be a surprise? Kind of the incorporation of...
Oh, showing photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I show photos, not a ton, but I tell some stories that are illustrated with photos, and the set is built so you could see it. So I tell a long story about throwing out the first pitch of the Mets game, but there's crazy photos of it going badly that all these sports photographers took. So
that's amazing.
You know, it's just like three or four stories where, you know, I'll talk about meeting Barack Obama, but I happen to have photos where you see it happen that are hysterically funny looking.
So why not throw it in and just enhance the whole experience?
It's just a visual.
Yeah, and so some of that is great. And you were there to see me perform with Eddie Vedder.
That I wanted to say that might be, I mean, I feel like I've seen a lot of cool shit. I don't know how anything gets cooler than that, because also I've never been in a room where I've where it's so comedically driven, and there's just so like much raw emotion, and but then also again, and you know, just the way you do it so brilliantly, you know, raw emotion, and then just before it gets to like, I mean, I'm like fighting back tears, and then like some funny comes right in and kind of saves the day, and it makes me not cry in front of other grown men. But
that was a special thing.
Can you break that? Yeah, I mean, tell us how that even...
In working on the documentary,
For Shandling.
About Shandling, I was reading his journals. He kept journals. And I saw Eddie Vedder at an event, and I asked him if he would do something with me at the comedy tent at Bonnaroo, because Pearl Jam was headlining.
Yeah.
And he said that he would, because I interviewed them, you know, for their last record, and have known, you know, Stone Gossard for a long time. And then I saw him at this Who did a benefit for, you know, kids' cancer. And I said to Eddie Vedder, well, what should we do? And he said, well, why don't I take some of Gary's journals and use them and make lyrics to a song? And I'll write a song with Gary's words in his journals. And his journals are very much about, a lot of it is about Buddhism and reminders to himself about, you know, non-attachment and you know, it has things in it that are like him trying to figure out how to deal with hecklers, or him trying to figure out how to be himself on stage. A lot of it is reminding himself to let go, and that if he lets go of all his nerves and all of his voices, that's when he'll be really funny, when he trusts that it's there. And it's really fascinating how it's almost like Zen and the Art of Archery with comedy.
Yeah.
And so I sent him a bunch of lyrics that I thought might apply, or even Gary journal pages, and he wrote this song and sent me this song that he wrote.
What was your first like?
And I couldn't believe it. It was beautiful. It's a really beautiful song. And then we get there, and he's going to rehearse it just in a little trailer. And then he goes, okay, so I'm going to do this part, and you do that part, and I'll do this part. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, it's a duet.
Oh,
and I said, no, I don't sing.
Yeah.
And he's like, no.
The rapper's over there. Get him, man.
I go, no, I don't sing. He goes, no. He goes, I'm not doing this alone. I was like, no. He goes, you do this and you do that, and then we sing this part together. Now, since I was like in kindergarten, there's nothing that scares me more than public singing.
Oh, really?
It's just I have a real fear about
There's not a lot of karaoke nights at the Apatow household.
I think it's like low self-esteem. Because I think when you sing, you're so purely yourself
yeah.
that if you have an issue with that, and as a kid, I always did. Like if someone said, "Now you sing this solo to this Kenny Loggins song," yeah. I would be terrified.
Not Loggins, just something I've said so many times.
Yeah.
Whenever I call you a friend.
Well, that and as a comic, there might be a mindset of like, as a comic, if a joke goes bad, you can adjust, you can figure it out, you can be like, oh, they want me to swear more, they want me to do more crowd work, whatever. As a song, it's like, no, that's your material.
Yes, and you have to commit. Right. And I don't know the song, so we basically do it once and a half.
Yeah.
You know, like two times in the trailer. I'm so nervous. So then I have to do a set in this like 1,000-seat tent.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all I'm thinking is Eddie Vedder's about to jump on stage. I actually had a great set because I was awesome. So nervous about the song, I wasn't nervous about the set.
No, you were just putting it out there. You weren't thinking too much.
And then he comes on stage. It's the biggest cheer I've ever experienced in my life. The reaction from that crowd. Now, the crowd is there basically to watch comedy to get into air conditioning before watching Pearl Jam that night.
Yeah.
So the crowd is hardcore Pearl Jam fans taking a break watching comedy. So when he suddenly pops up there, it's like, you know, it's
And even though it's a huge tent, that's a much more intimate venue to see Eddie Vedder than the acres of field which they're going to be playing that night.
Exactly. It's like everyone in the crowd, it's their dream that Eddie Vedder is going to walk in the tent and do anything.
Right.
And that blew my mind because, you know, we all hear applause when we go on stage or have a good set. It's 2% of what a rock star is getting. Oh, it's so much less. And then, you know, he didn't really know the song that well. And it's a difficult song because the
phrasings really
are very tricky.
Yeah.
You know, the words don't quite fit the music and it requires a lot of, you know, vocal gymnastics to get it out. Mm-hmm. And then he crushes it. And it doesn't make you cry. Like he captured the vibe of Gary's struggle.
Yeah.
You know, with his whole life in this song, and someone made a little documentary about it. I haven't released it yet. I might when the documentary on Gary comes out, which is a beautiful recording of the moment. Like it's actually presented well.
And then so he's getting everyone in tears and so much emotion and then he goes, and now your part, Judd.
Oh yeah. And then my voice cracks. It's really funny. Like the one thing I had to like sing, I'm like, and the crowd laughs. In the middle of the song, the crowd laughs because I'm just so far from hitting it up. But it's actually kind of sweet because I'm trying.
No, it was great. It was like it couldn't have been more perfect.
Yeah. Now, you definitely have, there's like definitely an Apatow crew of actors and actresses and people in a rotation. How does one infiltrate that, and then why do you continuously kind of use the same people?
Brad, why are you slipping Judd your resume?
Listen, he's got to know.
He slipped his digits.
He's got to know that.
Slipping your DMs.
He's got to know my one scene in Mascots was the greatest scene last year.
It was.
I think that, you know, a lot of it stems from, you know, you have certain projects and then you just feel connected to somebody on it. So, you know, with Seth Rogen, you know, I felt like a kindred spirit. And then, you know, there's other people you realize that I'm not going to see them if we don't work together. Like everyone works so much that there are people you go, we have to make something so we can
hang out.
I mean, when we did Funny People, one of the joys of it was that me and Adam Sandler had an excuse to talk a lot for a couple of years.
Because you used to live together, so you were, I mean, that was how many years when you guys were?
We lived together like around 90, 91, that area.
And you were around each other so much. And then,
and so just to have something to dig into.
Yeah.
Is fun, but it's none of it's very preconceived. It's just, oh, Kristen Wiig is so funny, let's ask her to be Knocked Up. Oh my God, she's so funny, let's put her in Walk Hard. Oh, I wonder if she has a movie, and it grows organically. And then people drift off and do the other things, and you work with other people. You can't really, you know, contain it.
Sure.
It, you know, it can't be the same cast every time. It drifts off and people have their own visions and that's sad too because you fall in love with the collaborators.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's a natural birth and death to those relationships.
Yeah.
That, you know, hopefully they kind of reignite at other times or they don't. But it's really fun when you know someone well you know, like Jonah, you know, he's in Knocked Up, and then he's in 40 Year Old Virgin, then he's in Knocked Up, and then he's in Superbad, and then we're doing Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and Get Him to the Greek, and you know, you start really understanding their moves and their lives, and you can get to deeper places when you know people well.
Sure,
that's why, you know, Scorsese likes De Niro. I mean, if it's your buddy, you know things about them you can bring to a project that a director who's not friends with them doesn't know that they can do.
Is it more of a risk than like Craig Robinson? How known was he before he was put in Knocked Up?
I think he was on The Office. And The Office had been on a year or so. He wasn't on a ton at that time. But I clearly thought that guy is unbelievable. And then I think he became big on The Office as well. Mm-hmm. But he came in and improvised the doorman part and Knocked Up. And I didn't know him personally.
So great.
And instantly we thought, oh my God, I mean, this is as funny as anybody gets.
Is that how it is in auditions for you? Like somebody just blows you out of the water with like the improv?
Occasionally. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one where, you know, the part's very thin. But usually what I think is, okay, it's a doorman who's kind of a dick. It's almost a generic idea.
Yeah.
If you can get someone who has so much personality and just brings a life to it, it becomes a whole other thing.
Yeah. He gave the bouncer a backstory.
Yeah.
Which is like you never think about stuff like that. Yeah.
His pain at denying people.
Yeah.
It's hard for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was such a... Because that's another person where you never think about what the bouncer went through that day or what's going on in his life. You're just like, here's the asshole that's preventing me from getting laid.
Exactly. And I think that's how you could look at any character, which is if you go deep and you really think through their life, even if someone has just a couple of lines, if you can understand them, then something else will come up that's much richer. Like Jane Lynch was the same thing. She came in for 40 Year Old Virgin. Mm-hmm. She had a take that I never would have thought of in a million years.
Oh, really?
And most of what's in the movie she improvised at the audition, and we were like, okay, we have to just transcribe this.
Oh my God. How often does that happen?
Very rarely.
There was I worked for Gene McCarthy when I first graduated from SC out here, and you know, would run a bunch of sessions, and then like for Sarah Marshall when Jack McBrayer auditioned, and I remember just watching, being like, hey, just like, okay, that's how you do it. That's how like if you're a pro. And then also everything he was saying, I mean, he left and we were like, is that all probably going to... I think Nick was there and was just like, oh, we'll probably use a bunch of that. That was all just so...
Well, you always have that moment where you think, oh, we have to hire that person because we need to use everything they just said.
Yeah.
And so we can't steal Jack McBrayer's improv. Like, yes, he got the part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's happened where someone is so funny that you might even like another person as much, but you go, I have to hire the person with the great improv because now... We know that has to be what is said.
Yeah, and you know it works.
Wow.
Yeah. It's something to where, I mean, because you're in on a lot of casting sessions, and I know that a lot of people in the industry listen to this podcast, young actors, comics. His mom, who's also trying to be
still
in the
trying
industry.
To act. Yeah, but she's done the Vagina Monologues 14 times. So if you're looking to do a movie version, I would love you to consider
bring
it.
Bring back the Where's the Beef commercials.
What is something that you let that impresses you in the room? How does someone audition for you and stand out?
Well, it's interesting because my kids act, and my daughter.
She's great in love.
My oldest daughter auditions. And so we talk a lot about what do you do in auditions? It's actually a big part of our house is how do you come across? How can you not be nervous? And the one thing I think people need to understand is you are you whether you like it or not. So you're not tricking anybody. So it is like a Shandling thing. I think Gary wrote in a book, why be nervous? Because even when I'm nervous, I'm still Gary.
Yeah.
So when I do anything, I'm Gary. So I might as well not be nervous because I've succeeded in being Gary even when I'm like nervous and falling apart.
Yeah.
That's still me. So I it's a triumph anytime I do anything because that's all I want them to know is who I am. So I think if you walk in a room and you realize that your main job is to find a way to get comfortable enough to just be yourself, that's really what people are ultimately judging. You know, there's acting skill, but a lot of it is just vibe. And, oh, this is, you know, imagine it's Craig Robinson. Mm-hmm. Craig Robinson is just like that. What's the point of him being nervous and being a little more separated from his true personality due to nerves? He just wants to get across what Craig Robinson is.
Yeah.
And that's all about relaxing and trusting and liking yourself, that I don't have to kiss your ass so much or be so nervous that you actually don't get a full sense of what I'm about. Separate from, you know, you have to learn how to act, and you have to, I do believe, like, acting ultimately is relaxing. You know, if you're not scared shitless, you might be able to get across to what you plan.
Yeah,
you have to be prepared and all that. But if you've ever sat on the other side of the camera and watched people walk in one after the other, that is the one thing you always notice, which is, I see what your thing is anyway. So all the bullshit can go away, because, you know, if it doesn't matter who it is, if it's, if it's a comic or if it's Jennifer Lawrence, when they walk in and say hello, most of the audition has already happened in the first 15 seconds.
Wow.
Like, if Craig walks in and he's just like, hey, what's up? You're like, oh, I like that guy. You know,
you know.
And so you might as well relax, because the thing that's going to get you it or not get you it has probably been determined almost before you read.
Jeez.
Like, imagine Jonah Hill walking in the office and chatting before the audition starts.
Yeah.
You go, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah.
And then you have to know how to act. You have to know your craft. But a lot of it is, is that part of it. Now, there are difficult roles, and you have to know what you're doing. I mean,
sure.
One of the great auditions ever was Steve Carell for Anchorman, which you could find on YouTube.
You were in the room for that.
It's just so funny. He's so skilled, and he's worked a long time to be able to do this, you know, Brick Tamlin eating garbage, because he thinks the garbage can is still part of the buffet line. I mean, it's just so funny.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever laughed as hard at almost anything I've witnessed anywhere.
Oh, my God.
And so, yes, you want to be that skilled that you can do that. But I think a big part of it is your inherent personality.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you've seen on the flip side then people coming in like overly prepared. I know I've done it early on with a story like that maybe just happened or just happened, you know, or a joke. And then you're shooting yourself in the foot by doing that, I think, right?
Well, you know, some people can get, you know, very uncomfortable. And when you're uncomfortable and needy, like if you're terrified or needy, it's not helpful.
Yeah.
But it's a real skill to walk into rooms with strangers and enjoy talking to them. You know, Kevin Hart talks about this a lot in his book. Kevin Hart's book is really great.
Awesome.
You know, he put a lot of work into trying to tell people how he did it. Because he's such a workaholic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he thinks it through. And a lot of his book about auditioning was that he thought, you know what, I'm probably not going to get this part, but I'm going to do something interesting every time. I'm going to make them laugh. I'm going to go for it because they might hire me for something else. And he really put thought into, how do I come across? How can they know I'm special in some way? But that's why stand-up helps, because you're just used to having to be yourself in weird situations.
Yeah, and in front of not a lot of people, especially starting out. You're like, I've walked in front of 10 strangers before.
Exactly.
And made them laugh with nothing. Yeah. So, yeah.
And a lot of it is being in the moment. You know, if it's weird, like if the moment's weird, calling it out. You know, very few people walk in a room and say there's like 11 people behind a desk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you walk in the room like, wow, this is weird. You guys are all behind that desk.
Yeah.
People like that. You know, they like that you're calling out the reality of it.
Yes, and also when you see someone in that audition, I'm sure what's going through your head is, yes, are they good and are they talented and are they qualified? But you've got to work with this person for 3-4 months.
Yeah, like, do I want to be around them? Like, I just taped one of those online courses, master class.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah.
Which I guess will come out next year. But one of the advice that, that I think is an important piece of advice is, so much of show business is being the kind of person people want to be around. Like, if you're a dick, it's over. Yeah. Or if you're just, you know, like in a comedy punch-up room, there are people who pitch a lot of jokes. Mm-hmm. And there are people who just criticize jokes and don't pitch fixes. And they're just kind of annoying, negative people. And we always call them room killers. Mm-hmm. Or just a weird person that's not productive. And,
right.
Yeah. And you go, oh, God, I've got to get rid of that guy.
Yeah.
How do we get rid of that? That guy's slowing the whole room down. Like, that guy's shutting down 11 people. He's such an annoying person. And that's a big part of show business is, oh, I like that person. That person's productive. They're overproducing.
Mm-hmm. And just in talking to you in this last hour, you've brought up the documentary. You brought up your Netflix special. You've brought up a side documentary. Yeah. You brought up this
Crashing on HBO.
Yeah, yes. Crashing on HBO.
The Avid Brothers documentary is on January on HBO.
Really? How do you keep all of this stuff straight in your head? Like, is
you'll watch it and see if I have. You'll see. You may decide I have not kept it straight and it's all low quality.
Do you just have this mentality of like, I can do it all? Or have you gotten really good at prioritizing, organizing, just like scheduling, obviously, right? Like, there's certain things you probably can't do because you're shooting the show. Or do you just, when you're producing something, you go, okay, cool, I'm going to be involved this much at the get-go, and then because I want to do this, I'll maybe check out a couple weeks in to work on that and then check back in? Is it?
A lot of it is building. Excuse me. A lot of it is you'll remove all these coughs, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to string one long whole excerpt of.
Yeah.
But
you know, someone auto-tune that, please.
Yeah. Exactly. You're creating a team, so if you're, you know, we're doing Crashing with Pete Holmes, you know, Pete's a great writer, and then you're figuring out, okay, how much can he write, and then who else is writing?
How early in do you and Pete sit down and you ask, like, how much do you want to be involved with writing all the episodes? Yeah,
the earliest possible stage, I'm paying attention to, well, how good a writer is Pete? Pete happens to be an amazing writer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I did something which I haven't done on other shows, which is I said, Pete, I think you should co-write every episode. So you're in the writing deeply on every episode.
Wow.
Where Lena wrote a lot of episodes, but also wrote a lot of episodes alone.
Lena Dunham, Girls.
Yeah, and she you know, co-wrote some, but wrote a lot alone because we also knew, like, on a weekend, Lena might just, like, crack one out of the blue.
Oh, really?
And we wanted to encourage that. And, you know, with Pete, I said, you know, you could write four of them where you're kind of leading the writing, and four where you have a co-writer and they're leading the writing and you're, you know, getting deeply involved. And I think, you know, that you can handle that. And then this year, you know, Pete's like, you know, maybe I'll write a few less because the staff's getting stronger and I don't need to write on all eight. Maybe I'll write on five.
Yeah.
And so that's what you're tuning into is, you know, how does your staff work? So, you know, on Love, one of our producers, who used to be one of my assistants, Michael Lewin, we realized he's amazing at editing. Mm. So he's been gets more and more deeply involved in sitting in the edits. And then I can sit in the edits less and just, you know, be used when I'm needed. And that's really what it is. It's like, who does what well? Where do I help? Because no one else can do the thing I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, my intention is to do nothing. So if on everything I do, my intention is to do nothing,
yeah,
then I just go to the place that isn't working right. So it might be, oh, I'm helpful breaking the stories, but I don't need to be involved in the first drafts of the scripts, but I need to then be involved in fixing the scripts or whatever. It might be the opposite of that. Oh, my God, they're breaking great stories. I'll write more. I mean, and on every project, it's different.
It takes a minute, too, to figure out how much you want to be involved, like, and how much to pull back on your own self, because there might be opportunities when you're like, oh, I would love to write more of that, but maybe
it's going to
be more
time.
Beneficial. Yeah.
You know, even The Big Sick, Michael Showalter directed. So, you know, he really knows what he's doing. I don't need to babysit him. And so, you know, I spent, you know, some time on the set, but I wasn't there most of the time.
How much of how Bridesmaids were?
Bridesmaids, I've got Paul Feig there. I've worked, you know, with Paul for a long time. Yeah. So, you know, maybe I'm on the set, you know, a quarter of the time or a third of the time, and mainly on just scenes that I think, you know, on that day I might catch something. But I know that between Paul and Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo and Paul LaPell, the great writer, was on set, I don't need to be there. And if they have a question, they call. And then on other movies, you know, I'll just go, I think I need to be in this one a lot for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's my sense of humor. I'm like, you know what? I kind of get this more than other people, so I'm going to hang around this one a lot.
Go ahead.
Is it hard to wear the different hats? Is it hard to be like, okay, I'm a producer, so when you see a director doing something, it's like, ooh, I would have done it this way, but
it's really sometimes a pain in the ass to everyone if I am around, because I would do it a certain way, mm-hmm. and that is not necessarily the right way.
Yeah, it's just your way.
So if I've talked about, for instance, in Bridesmaids, I'm just trying to think like one of the great sequences.
Melissa McCarthy trying on dresses
shitting like in a sink.
yeah, like the big bridal sequence. Yeah. You know, we talked about it a lot, like how it would work. But I didn't ride it that much because I could tell Paul had this hilarious vision of how it would all mm-hmm. work. And then you don't want me going, I think the camera would be a little closer up on this shot. Like you could really throw people off
their
game. You
direct as Kermit the Frog.
Exactly.
that's quite a talent.
You'll never play the amphitheater.
And that's a difficult thing because sometimes you're wrong. Like, oh, wow, that scene did not come out well and I didn't choose to be there that day. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, someone said to me once, like, you got to let the director direct it. Like, that's their job, and you support them, and you pay attention to where it might go wrong. Sometimes I show up on, like, emotional days. Like, oh, I'm kind of good with the scene where it has to be emotional and funny simultaneously, and that's a little tricky to do. And I might make a point of, like, on my calendar go, be there for the day that they make up after the big fight. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I show up, and oh, they got it. They don't need any help. And other days I'm deeply helping and rewriting and figuring it out.
I've seen on DVD extras you chime in. Are you good for like 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Yeah. I've seen on DVD extras you chiming in from the back during a scene, like I think maybe Pineapple Express or whatnot, of just throwing out, you know, additional alt lines and whatnot. Yeah. And, you know, now getting a chance to work with Paul Hamphill, seeing how he does that a lot too, and which is kind of just so brilliant to me because it's like when you're just so locked in the scene and just throwing out these and giving not only just like say this, but then it seems like from the people you've picked, like, are good at taking that and making it even into something more. My question is, will you do that for an emotional scene, or is that just
absolutely? Yeah, I think it's the same thing. I mean, it's a weird way to do it that I think I learned from Stiller when we were doing the sketch show, the Ben Stiller show.
Yeah,
Ben would just try to get a lot of material. So if he had he used to do this character, Michael Ferret, which was like Ferret, who was an agent, and he would represent someone, and the scene would just be him giving advice that was terrible to a star. So we did one with Run DMC,
nice.
We did one with Howie Mandel, and one with Roseanne and Tom, and in one he was mad at Roseanne and Tom for losing weight, and he was just like, you know what, you got to gain it back, you got to gain it back. Fat is funny. You know, you got to go get a cheeseburger, but what he would do is he would just do so much extra material.
Yeah.
And then sometimes when the person he was doing it with would leave, he would go do it again without them there.
Wow.
Because there were certain jokes he was afraid to say to their faces.
Oh, jeez.
Roseanne
comes back like, why did you call me a fat pig? Like, well.
And that was what, and then, you know, and he would want me to yell out any other joke ideas to him. And I realized, oh, so you can get so much stuff, and so you could do that in a comedy. I mean, the key is you want to direct the scene and do the scene a bunch of times normally.
Yeah.
You don't want to be yelling crap at people when they're trying to act.
Right.
But at the end, when you feel like you have the scene, you could say, okay, let's get these 20 lines, or let's improvise here to get extra stuff. And then usually someone says something you never could think of in a million years because they're allowed to take a chance. Mm-hmm. So even in Knocked Up, we always said, what would Seth say when she says, I'm pregnant? Like, what would his response be? Yeah. And we had some funny jokes, which is, you know, she goes, I'm pregnant. And he says, with emotion?
Yes.
And that was in the movie. But the reaction before that, which was just a Seth improv, was she says, I'm pregnant. And he goes, fuck off. And then she goes, what? He goes, what?
Yeah.
Only because we're creating extra space for people to play and get real and also allow their comedy and comedy writing to come to the surface. That's when something very special happens. And sometimes it doesn't. You're just doing the script. But in every situation, you do want to take a moment to go, well, you know, what would Chris and Wig say if we, you know, took the handcuffs off and just, you know, what else do you want to say? Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else you would do here? Because a lot of it is getting a lot of bullets for your gun in editing. You just want to feel like if a joke doesn't work, you can turn to the editor and go, what else we got?
Yeah.
And you want him to go like, I got eight other jokes. Because awesome. Sometimes your joke sucks and you go, what else we got? And they go, nothing.
Fuck. Yeah, boy.
Well, you're such a brilliant writer, and I know you like to. So, I mean, do you ever, when you're writing something, go, all right, this is so good, I don't even want to give room to improv? Or, like, and so when you get on.
Sure.
So, yeah.
There are times where the
can
scene,
you over improv?
You can lose sight of what your intention is.
Yeah, yeah.
Improv only works if you know, I got to get from A to B, and here's the emotional path of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, for instance, if Seth and Katherine Heigl are fighting at the gynecologist and they're screaming at each other, we know how it needs to build and what the exit is, mm-hmm. but the actual insults and things can be a little different. There's a little play.
Yeah.
And somewhere you get to, you know, go fuck your bong. And you might discover that in the moment because everyone's like getting in the spirit of, like, what would that fight be?
Yeah.
How mean would you get? What would she make fun of him about? You know, she knows he's a pothead. She's never made fun of it.
Yeah.
And now suddenly she's just like, go fuck your bong. And you realize in the back of her mind has been, you're a dirty pothead and you're the father of my child. And I'm so upset about it.
Yeah.
And that a lot of times comes out in improvs. Like the truth comes out if everything's in everyone's unconscious when you just say, okay, just go. Let's see what comes out of your head.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and what comes out of your head might be what comes out of my head or Seth's head or whoever's trying to pitch extra jokes. Sometimes we have extra writers hanging around pitching jokes.
Has anybody ever pitched something on a set like it's such a loose collaborative set, like a craft service guy?
Oh, of course.
Oh,
yeah.
For real? You're open to that.
Our first AD, Matt Rebenkoff, we were doing Trainwreck, and we had a joke where, you know, Amy is about to have sex with the intern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about safe words, and I think he says, my safe word is pineapple. And she's like, okay. And like, not sure why there is a safe word. Like, you know, so you're setting up like, oh, this guy's a little weirder than we thought. But then when she punches him in the face, he starts crying and screaming pineapple over and over again. And that Matt Rebenkoff is like, shouldn't he say the safe word at the end? And it wasn't in the scripts. And we're like, oh, that's the perfect joke.
Yeah.
So we're always open for that.
That's awesome.
And that's good that you are willing to take those jokes from the first AD and not just be like, we have writers for a reason, asshole.
There's a lot of people that do not want anyone else to think of anything.
Mm-hmm.
I've met all sorts of people. They hate when other people are involved in the process. They just want to own every word, like, everything was me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is not the best way to do comedy, at least.
Yeah.
Might work for Arthur Miller.
Yeah.
What if people are trying to get into films or TV from a behind the camera perspective? What are common mistakes that people make?
To for technical people and
or like if someone wants to be a director?
Yeah. Well, like, the interesting thing now is, you know, you can do anything with your phone. So if you wanted to prove you could direct, you can make a movie for free on your phone. There's no excuse not to do it. Because it doesn't cost anything anymore. It used to be, what are you going to buy Super 8 film? And say you made a film. How are you going to bring your projectors to some movie executive's office?
Right.
Now, like if you suddenly just made something hysterical and put it on Funny or Die and say it happened to be better than everyone else's thing, it would get seen.
Yeah.
Someone would, like if something is truly great, it's obvious. Because most stuff, no matter how much stuff is up on the web, it's all shit.
Yeah.
I mean, think about the last time you saw a little 5-minute short that blew your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I remember seeing Bottle Rocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a black and white short that Wes Anderson made. And you knew right away, oh, this is one of the greats of all time. And that opportunity is there for anybody who isn't lazy and wants to just pull their phone out and create something.
Yeah. It's like you want to tell people, it's like no one's going to knock on your door. You open and they go, hey, we're Hollywood. Here's a bag of money. You're now a producer or you're now a director.
Yes, exactly.
Or whatever. That's not going
to
happen.
I think you have to make something.
I think Two Girls, One Cup was the last thing I saw that really blew my mind.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten around to like,
and you don't need to,
seeing it.
That was not me setting up like, and here's the clip, Jared.
Well, I mean, so don't show it to him.
No, please,
like, have it queued
up. No, don't. It's too early.
I love that Amy Schumer sketch. Oh, it was on the pilot episode, just the audition. Yeah. So
it's brilliant.
Funny. As funny as it gets.
Yeah.
Really as funny as it gets.
Yeah. And then is there anything that you've yet to do where you're like, okay, eventually I'm going to get to this project or this thing?
I'd like to write a play or a musical. I'd like to do something for the theater at some point. I took a year and didn't do anything but tried to figure it out and failed. Didn't write one word in a year.
Wow.
So
why'd you do that? Just to live? And
I just was. I had some ideas and I don't know. I just locked up and didn't write one word. I tried to outline a little bit, did some research, but I do think that it would be really fun to try to put something up, punch it up every day, see it again, punch it up some more.
Fuck yeah.
But I haven't really cracked it. But that's maybe one of the main dreams that I'd like to try in the next 10 years.
Okay.
That's what I heard. Great Jim Henson, like when I heard some interview with his son, Brian, talking about what his plans were, because he was like a god to me. And I'm just like, God, I can only imagine now, like what he did in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but like now with like just the technologies we have.
Sure.
And he was talking about all these grand things he had for these like, 3D interactive like plays with like the sets being all Muppified and stuff. And I'm just like, yeah, I mean, that would have been like just bonkers.
Exactly.
Didn't you? We have a story in your act about him, but is right about meeting.
Well, Adam Sandler and I, when we were kids, auditioned to host this reality show. You know, right when camcorders became inexpensive and America's Funniest Videos went on the air, everyone was like, "What can we do with camcorders? It's cheap." Mm-hmm. And it was some drive across the country, reality-driven show before people had figured out how to do that. I did another pilot with Colin Quinn that was like that, like comedians traveling across the country, and it's reality but kind of scripted, that half fake thing that I guess all the shows are. We were trying to crack. And so anyway, Adam and I auditioned and I didn't get it, and neither did Adam. I think Dana Gould is the one who got it.
Oh wow.
But when
shots
I didn't get
fired,
it
Gould
exactly. I'm still mad about it. But Jim Henson's people called and they wanted to buy all the ideas I pitched for it.
Wow. Amazing.
Which I thought, well, that's kind of cool that he thinks I'm a good writer.
Yeah. And then just do them.
Yeah. And then they said, but we don't want him on the show because we think he lacks warmth. And I say on stage, I say, that's like Mr. Rogers telling you don't deserve love.
Yeah, the creator of Sesame Street.
Yes.
Yeah.
It hurt.
Man, this was unbelievable. Yeah. Thank you for making time.
Thank you.
And
good to be here.
Thank you for getting us up at 6:30 in the morning and having it be worth it.
Can I be honest? It's like, I know you've adjusted to this time frame, but it's like once I am up, like I'm up. But it's like, again, I'm such a night owl. And
it's brutal. And the rest of your day is going to be terrible.
And that's positive reinforcement from Judd Apatow.
You're going to be so tired. You're going to have an audition. You'll do
I
got to
go shoot
on
it right after this.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. You're shooting today.
Arrested, yeah.
Oh, excellent. I went and visited the other day.
Did you love that show?
Oh, I was saying hi to Jeffrey Tambor and Michael Cera. And
that's got to be so great where you just think like, oh, I'm just going to stop by the set of whatever.
Well, I was mixing the sound to my stand-up special.
Yeah.
And someone said, oh, Arrested is right there. And it was fun to just go watch them work. And
So was Sarah,
no one's funnier than Michael Cera.
I agree.
Right? Have you seen Lemon, the Brett Gelman movie?
No.
Oh.
I love Brett Gelman, though.
Unbelievable.
Really?
So Michael Cera in Lemon, it might be the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Funnier than him in Superbad?
Very close. I mean, it's...
Holy shit.
He's doing this douchey actor. It's so funny.
He's playing one?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, thank you, guys.
Thanks for... and the special one more time.
December 12th on Netflix, and then Love Comes Back. Sometime in the spring, and Crashing comes back in January. And
fuck. So just keep your TV on, and eventually a Judd Apatow project will come across it, whether it be on a rerun of a movie or a new show or
Celtic Pride. Special.
I mean,
don't joke about that.
Celtic Pride sequel in the works. Got it.
If they can talk about a Space Jam sequel, they can talk about a Celtic Pride sequel. Kidnapping LeBron, or just go a different kidnap, like Dirk or Sasha Vujicic, like somebody nobody expects to get kidnapped.
I think someone already kidnapped Sasha Vujicic. I haven't seen him in a while.
He looks very kidnappable. All right, thanks, Judd.
Thanks, Judd.
So, that's the show. Thanks for tuning in. We had laughs and stories. Now go listen to more episodes on iTunes or your phone. Subscribe and tell your family and everyone you know.
But what should I tell them? Well, you can just tell them that
Brad Williams and Adam Ray can help you get through the fucking day. Just follow us on Twitter at Funny Brad, and I'm at Adam Ray Comedy. This has been the About Last Night podcast. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.